U.S. Legal Support is a proud sponsor of the Legal Face-Off podcast. With over 85 locations around the country and one of the leading providers of litigation services, U.S. Legal Support is the only litigation support company that not only provides a full suite of court reporting solutions to major insurance companies, corporations, and law firms nationwide, they provide their clients with record retrieval, interpreting and translations, trial services, and transcription services. You can always count on U.S. Legal Support to provide reliable and efficient litigation support services. Visit uslegalsupport.com to find out more.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
WGN. Welcome in, Legal Face Off here on WGN. Rich Linkoff and Tina Martini, the Legal Eagles, as we broadcast for the last time in October. Happy Halloween, by the way.
Yay.
What are we wearing? Are we wearing something next episode or?
Yeah, we got to dress as maybe some former Legal Face-Off guests. Maybe I'll go as like Dershowitz.
Oh my God.
Like maybe like late 70s Dershowitz.
I'll go as a Gloria Allred.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And maybe someone goes as Mike Heidemann.
I was going to go as Jason Whiteside.
There you
actually.
Go.
So I'll just disappear in the middle of the night. That's how it goes. Plenty of topics to get to. We'll talk about the NCAA in California, teacher strikes in just a moment, Inside Out, and of course, the legal grab bag at the end of the show. But joining us now to talk about the teacher strikes, whether they're legal or not, Miley Smith, staff attorney and director of labor policy at Illinois Policy, joining us to lead off the show on Legal Face-Off. Miley, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Miley, last week, the Chicago Teachers Union went on strike. We are 6 days into the strike, fourth day of no school for students. The Chicago Teachers Union rejected Mayor Lightfoot's offer of a 16% salary hike over 5 years. Where does the strike currently stand?
You know, this strike demonstrates a new front for union demands. Like you said, she's offered 16% pay raises over 5 years, but the teachers are still out. They have not come to an agreement at this point. And the real sticking point here is that the union, CTU, is demanding things that are not typical economic issues that are usually in a contract. And that is why those are the things that they are pressing, like class size, increased staffing, new community schools. Those types of things are not typically written into a contract, especially in Chicago public schools. And because CPS is not putting those things in writing in the way that CTU wants them, the teachers are still out on strike.
Mel, I know from the article and from your background, you don't buy the teachers' argument as to why they're striking, right? I mean, you're not buying the idea that this is all because of class sizes and more nurses.
Right.
Tell us what you think the real reason that the teachers are striking.
We see this as a political power play to reassert dominance in Chicago. CTU donated nearly $300,000 to Tony Preckwinkle's campaign, and then she lost. And as a side note, $164,000 of that was in union dues directly from CTU. But CTU's candidate didn't win. She lost in all 50 wards. And we see this as CTU, you know, like I said, reasserting their dominance, saving face. They want to show that they are the ones in control, and they don't want Lori Lightfoot to be in control. And you know, what's interesting here is that not even a progressive mayor who won by wide margins is safe from this assertion of dominance and, you know, who is controlling what goes on at CPS.
Do you think that that explains why there have been so many strikes over the past 7 years or threatened strikes?
It does. And that's one reason why we're seeing a shift nationwide in the types of things that teachers' unions are demanding. But one thing that makes Illinois different and the reason why we see so many strikes here is that Illinois is unique in allowing teacher strikes. There are in teacher strikes are illegal in most major cities. Chicago's the outlier. New York City, Miami-Dade, Houston, teachers can't go on strike. And in fact, teacher strikes are illegal in most of our neighboring states. Missouri would be the only, I guess, exclusion, but they just don't have it. It's not explicit.
Miley, explain why. Explain why. Because eight of the 10 largest U.S. school districts make striking by teachers illegal. Yet, as you point out, our state doesn't have that provision. What is the logic behind making teacher strikes illegal? I mean, I could tell you the obvious logic for me, being the parent of two CPS students who are now entering their fourth day, you know, not learning a damn thing.
Right.
What's the logic behind making that illegal, and why does our state make it legal or make it illegal?
Well, actually, our state expressly makes it legal. So it is legal for teachers to go on strike.
So why is our state different?
What we see is one of the reasons that our state is different is that the unions have such a hold on governing power here in the state of Illinois. The unions are incredibly politically active. They, like I mentioned, CTU donating $300,000 to Preckwinkle. That's just the tip of the iceberg for CTU. They actually last year donated over $1.2 million for political purposes over the course of just 1 year. So that political dominance plays a role in what our laws allow teachers and other government workers to do in terms of striking.
All right. So if it's your opinion that this is really pure politics, a lot of that obviously depends on public sentiment in favor of the teacher striking or opposing it, right? I mean, the last time they struck in 2012, initially, that was a one-week strike. Initially, a lot of parents were supporting the teachers because generally parents support teachers, right? That's what you want to do. But as the week went on and as parents had to deal with the realities of childcare and their children, you know, wasting time outside of school, then I think sentiment changed. The vibe seems to be a little bit different this time. I feel like parents are now more overwhelmingly in favor of the teachers, and perhaps that is because of the messaging coming out of CTU. I think that as, you know, the strike progresses, the same feeling will start to pervade among the parents, but right now it seems like, you know, Sharkey is winning this battle and Lightfoot is losing.
Did say that in an October 2nd House of Delegates meeting that they're in a PR battle with Mayor Lightfoot. And so they are waging a PR battle. The problem is what we are going to see play out is that the price of this PR battle is going to be paid by parents and students, whether they see it, you know, immediately or not. We know that there is academic harm. When the studies show that the longer students are out, if they're out 10 or more days, that it directly impacts and permanently impacts their academic standing. It hurts them socially. There's no sports right now. We are in the midst of the sports season, and you know, there's no after school activities. It's going to hurt parents financially. Initially, it's going to hurt with regard to childcare or having to take time off work, but they're ultimately going to be the ones that are paying the cost for these demands through their property taxes. You know, Chicagoans are already overtaxed. They're going to feel the burden of this, whether or not they see it right now. They are going to be the victims of this strike.
So where do we go from here? I mean, you mentioned about the taxpayers and what it's going to cost. I mean, there are a variety of estimates that I saw, one of which was $1.1 billion over 3 years.
Right.
Where do we go from here?
That's $1.1 billion over 3 years just for the salary increases, the extra staff, and the new schools.
Yeah, the whole
that
package
doesn't even
color
all of their demands.
Yeah, the whole package was about $2.5 billion by some estimates, right?
Yeah, so you know, it's a great question. What is there to do when CTU is demanding that CPS do things that are so costly? It really shows that CTU is out of touch with the realities faced by fellow Chicagoans. I mean, CPS has a junk credit rating. They're already borrowing to meet day-to-day obligations. So where we see this going is harm to the residents of Chicago. It's going to cost more. They're going to feel the brunt of it. And we already know that people are leaving. So what we're going to see is, you know, a continued exodus of people from the city of Chicago.
Well, I know for sure the fourth and fifth grade Agassiz Bulldogs flag football team that I coach is idle all week. We tried to have a scrimmage yesterday, but four kids showed up, and I was all-time quarterback, and Sam knows how that goes. So, yeah, it's definitely affecting our academics in my household.
I picture the Peyton Manning SNL skit, just
yes,
throwing darts at
absolutely
the kids.
Absolutely,
yeah, absolutely. That's how it goes. All right, Miley Smith, Staff Attorney, Director of Labor Policy, Illinois Policy. Miley, thank you so much for making time for us.
Yeah, thank you.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off. You can follow the show on Twitter. You can like the show on Facebook. You can always find us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. Please rate, review after you listen to the show. Joining us now on the lines, very impressive background, Gene Marsh, who's of counsel at Jackson Lewis, but also professor emeritus at the University of Alabama Law School. 9 years on the NCAA Infractions Committee. He also chaired that committee, and the former faculty athletic rep at Alabama for 7 years. Joining us now on the line, Mr. Marsh, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Gene,
happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. In the news, of course, recently is in California, the Fair Play to Pay Act, which was signed by Governor Gavin Newsom last month. It won't become law until 2023, but it now, for the first time, allows athletes, student athletes, to be paid for use of their likeness. They can earn endorsement and sponsorship money. This is obviously something that you are intimately familiar with, this concept generally of student athletes being paid. Do you think this is a trend? Do you think it will hold up in the court? What do you think will happen? Obviously, the NCAA has come out strongly against it, calling it a new form of professionalism. But how do you think this will play out?
You know, I don't know. California is just from the sort of law professor end of things. California has always been, or frequently has been, first in the country to have X. X could be lots of different things, X in tort law or other areas of law. They've often been first with some new idea, but I don't think they have ever won a whole lot of awards for the detail of, you know, how all of it might work. And here, the you know, the old line, the devil is in the details, and it surely is here as well. It seems to me that the country and most folks who are just fans are once again out in front of the NCAA. The NCAA is frequently, and even people there acknowledge that they are often on the trailing edge of issues and be sort of be begrudgingly being brought along. But I think people largely think that at least at the upper end schools where athletes might have some value, and that's what I would also stop to consider, how many athletes really, unless you did some sort of community pool compensation idea, how many athletes, even at, say, Alabama, where everybody knows who the quarterback is or whatever, but how many people know who the second string
How many will really be able to sell their likeness, right? How many will really be able to get an endorsement?
Yeah, so it's good for people to just sort of calm down on the idea that, you know, this would just lead to turning on the television at every moment and you've got, you know, your right guard selling tires on OK Tire Store. I don't think it's ever going to come to that. But I also think that I think when you said the NCAA fought, you know, it came out against swinging against it and all that, that's certainly true to some extent. But, you know, they've got some time, as you pointed out, with the effective date of this. And they have this group of people working on it. And I think Gene Smith, the AD at Ohio State, is heading that up. And I was on the infractions committee with him a couple of years. He is a reasonable guy and a smart guy and a former athlete. And he's an advocate for student athletes. And if you listen closely to what a lot of people in athletics say, including a lot of athletic directors and whatever, their comments are fairly tempered. I mean, as far as more or less acknowledging, a lot of them are tempered, acknowledging that they know that change is coming. So then it's just a matter of who, what, when, and where. You know, it's the details now that matter. The sure. California legislation sort of kicking the butt to the NCAA, but also beware. The NCAA is like Fort Knox when it comes to litigation budgets. I mean, they fight tooth and nail and give up ground foot by foot if they choose to do that. But I don't think it's all that politically popular right now.
All right, so pick up on that point. You were inside these rooms, right? You worked for the NCAA for 9 years. You know the culture there. Why does the NCAA trail behind society as a whole, and why are they so stringent in their position on this issue, given that you are correct in that polls show, and most, I think, logical people realize that given the disparity between what the NCAA makes and what universities make in endorsements and the billions of dollars that are flowing through colleges as a result of athletics, when you compare that to what these athletes make, which is, you know, nothing, is the NCAA falling so far behind? Is it just a question of money? They're greedy?
Well, a couple of things. One, I never worked for the NCAA. Everybody always thinks if you're on the committee on infractions, you work for the NCAA. I was always a law professor at Alabama. I never got paid a paycheck by the NCAA. So that's a nit, and I don't want to go off on that road. But I just also want it to be clear, because people who know the system, if they heard you say that, they would be getting on you about characterizing me as working for the NCAA.
Understood.
So, but it's true. You're right in that, you know, if you're on the infractions committee, you're in the middle of cases, many cases that involve athletes getting money, and if the rules were a little more liberal, you might not have had even a case. You know, so I get it. I get your point. To some degree, I mean, the NCAA is, first, think of what that means. Everyone likes to think that that means Mark Emmert and the people in the building in Indianapolis, but what that largely means is the membership, because legislation, even though the people in the building in Indy shape things and they shape memberships on committees, et cetera, this model only changes when the membership votes in favor or against it. So you've got this array of schools, and even if you pick, say, all the D1 schools, you've got the schools that are making hand over fist, and then, you know, you've got the Alabamas and Ohio States and Texas and whatever. But then you have a giant percentage, a very large majority of the schools who are in the red, and that's not overstated. If you go from year to year to year, you really, no matter what kind of accounting gimmickry you do, you've got about 25 schools maybe who are really fully self-supporting in the black, and all the rest, as they stand, they are standing with heavy subsidies from campus and student activity fees, et cetera. So anything that opens any financial door anywhere creates some opposition, because the schools that are the have-nots are still fighting like hell to try to stay up with the haves, and they're losing the battle. I mean, everybody knows that parity is kind of a joke. When Alabama is hosting West Carolina here in Tuscaloosa or those kinds of schools, everybody knows that that concept is pretty much out the window. So some of the opposition really does come from people who wear the, you know, the cloak. They're the sort of the priests and nuns of this model. They're the ones that think amateurism is still something that you kind of genuflect every time you say the word. But a whole lot of the opposition comes from people who don't want to spend more money. Now, the interesting thing about this concept is it largely would be money coming from outside. You know, I mean, it's outside folks who want to pay some money to use athletes, but name, image, likeness, whatever. But it also wouldn't be costless for the schools. I mean, all these schools have very robust compliance programs. Ohio State, Alabama, whatever, they have 10, 11, 12 people in compliance, many of whom have law degrees. And if some model like this gets passed, it will almost surely create staffing issues, et cetera. That's no reason to not have it happen. I view that it's largely going to happen in some form. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if Gene Smith and his crew came up with some model that is more liberal than the current model, but it's just not wide open. So you've got, you know, you don't have your first string tight end pushing taco night at, you know, the local bar or whatever. I don't think it's going to come to that, but I think there will be some liberalization.
So, Gene, let's talk about the recent alleged infractions at big-time programs like Kansas, NC State, LSU, Arizona, Miami, and Auburn. Locally, we had the DePaul men's basketball coach suspended for three games, and the program was placed on probation for alleged recruiting violations. As the former chairman of the NCAA Committee on Infractions, do you think that they can clean this up?
Well, I totally get why a person like you would be asking that question, and you have to totally get why I am not interested in answering any question that relates to a specific school. You know, I mean, some of them are my clients. Some of them are, I have enough respect to know that unless you know their facts, you don't know what's happening. But as far as the idea of continuing to try to, quote, clean things up, I had somebody tell me that being involved in NCAA compliance is like being dean of chastity in a high school. I mean, you know, no matter how many meetings or memos or whatever you do, you're always going to have something going on. Or another person said that you're really like a piano player in a house of ill repute. They used a different word than house of ill repute. You know, in other words, you may be in athletic compliance. You may be playing the most beautiful song you can, but there's something else going on behind the curtain, and I don't think that's ever going to stop. It's like saying if the IRS brings enough showy cases, it'll stop people from cheating on their taxes. It's just not going to happen. And it used to be a far smaller problem when the amount of money that was flowing was far smaller. But now the stakes are so high, and the amount of money that schools lose if they get a postseason ban or whatever is such a blast and such a hit to them that it just magnifies all that's going on, including people's willingness to go out and cheat and think that they're not going to get caught. I mean, think of all the things that have gone on, say, in the men's basketball cases where you had the NCAA compliance program supposedly watching and trying to infiltrate, meaning like gather intelligence in men's basketball, and they largely seem to have swung through the pitch. So I don't think that's going to change. It's like saying, you know, are people going to stop being attracted to sex? No. And so, I mean, that's how I view that. You have a regulatory model that catches some people. It's subject to criticism. It has some evenness to it. And you know what that means? Welcome to the world. I mean, that's the way it is in the IRS and the Securities Exchange Commission or state, you know, whatever. I mean, it's the way it is on the interstate. You know, the state highway patrolman pulls over one speeder and then somebody else blasts right by him when he's writing or she's writing a ticket. So, welcome to the world. I don't think, you know, you just keep trying to do what you do.
Great stuff. That's Gene Marsh, Professor Emeritus, University of Alabama, of counsel at Jackson and Lewis. Thank you for joining us so much on WGN.
You bet. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
We all know the legal world is complex and high-pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off here on WGN with Rich and Tina. My name is Sam, and joining us now on the phones, we thought he'd be in studio, but I guess I should have known better. The co-host, or the co-writer of Inside Out, Chicago Law Magazine, David Sussler, Associate General Counsel at National Material LP, and the latest edition is titled No Regrets. He writes it with Tina Martini. Welcome, David. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
David, you talk in the article about things that you wish you knew earlier in your career. Why don't you share that with our listeners?
There's a lot I wish I knew earlier in my career. I would say I probably wish, number one, that I wasn't going to want to be a plaintiff's personal injury attorney the rest of my life. And I wished I had known how much I was going to love the business world and being an in-house generalist, because I would have paid a whole lot more attention to the business world growing up and going through school, and saved some of the painful learning curve I encountered when I moved in-house.
Tina, same question?
I guess I wish that I knew how much the legal profession was going to change. I mean, I think at the end of the day, I got great training and I started at a really great firm that worked well for me for a long time. I think that working on my network a bit earlier than I did would have probably been the most meaningful. And also taking the patent bar, which I was qualified to do, but decided not to just because I had already spread myself across a couple of practice areas more when I was a more junior attorney. But I think the networking is something that a lot of folks can learn from even today. It's so important to have those relationships.
So, David, it's important always, I think, not just as a lawyer, but as an adult, to be introspective and to learn from prior mistakes as you proceed with your life and your career. Why is it important to realize what your regrets are, and how is it best to deal with them once you identify those regrets?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I think it's important to know where you've come from, and even if, you know, regrets, like I say in the column, I don't really like to have regrets, but we all certainly at least make mistakes, and they help inform us at going forward so that we don't repeat the mistakes of our past. And as we grow and learn and move through things and find, you know, I'm not so crazy about this anymore, our regrets and our past and our mistakes can help us figure out a path to doing something that we find much more fulfilling in many different ways, which is kind of the essence of my change from growing up wanting to be a plaintiff's personal injury lawyer and having tunnel vision towards personal injury, and a few years into that, realizing I didn't enjoy it. It wasn't fulfilling. I didn't want to do it, but I didn't know what was next. So, you know, I got lucky backing into being an in-house attorney and realizing, hey, I love this. And so the ability to take a look at it from, say, the 10,000 or 50,000 foot view is a really empowering tool for moving forward and ensuring you can have a happier, more fulfilling career and life in general.
Tina, I'm the kind of attorney who, when I leave a deposition or a trial or a court appearance, even sometimes, I will generally on the ride home think of something I wish I would have done differently. I wouldn't call it exactly regret, but I always try to think of what, again, I might have done differently. Is it healthy to sometimes have regrets and learn from them and how to do things differently the following time professionally as a lawyer?
I think that's a really great question, Rich, because I think that you hit the nail on the head that sometimes things don't really rise to the level of regret. You're always trying to improve yourself, and I don't think choosing to do things a bit differently or thinking you wish you'd done things differently necessarily is a, you know, rises to the level of a regret. I do think it's important to always improve and to always try to think through, did you handle something as well as you could have? And I think it's important for a couple of reasons. Number one, you're always going to like think about it a little bit differently the next time. And also you can help mentor people as they're coming, you know, up the ranks, or, and you can help them sort of think through what they may want to do differently depending on how circumstances play out.
It's the jerk store response, right? Jerk store. When Costanza wishes he gave the jerk store response, that the jerk store called and they're out of view instead of what tepid response he gave during that meeting. So, Sussler, what about things that you've done well? You talked a little bit about things you wish you would have done differently. Are there anything that you want to point to, and you talk in your article about things that you did particularly well that you don't regret, that you actually think worked out pretty well?
Sure. You know, I think the thing I'm most proud of is the mentoring that I do of law students, and really all the way down to high school students up through young professionals. That kind of goes to what Tina was just saying. A lot of my mentoring comes from the mistakes I've made along the way and rethinking them and thinking, well, how can I do it better? What have I done to become a better attorney and a better person and pass that wisdom along? So I think I've done that extremely well. And of course, as I get older and farther into my career, and again, I am rather retrospective and introspective, so I have a career-long arc to look at and realize some underlying themes in my practice, and the way that I conduct myself with my clients at work now, that I do talk about in the article that I'm very proud of, is my goal in interacting with all the employees in the company is to, in what some way or another, make their jobs easier and to leave them with a positive impression of the legal profession, which I think is very important to do. And, you know, to know that my clients are satisfied with the advice I give them, because that goes to making their job easier and making our company more successful. And I think I've done a good job of that, and I'm proud of it.
There's a word in this edition, and also a word, David, you just used. I think I'll start with you, and then if Tina wants to jump in, positive or positivity. This is inundated throughout this piece and throughout the conversation we're having here. How important is it to focus primarily on the positives? I mean, you want to always remember the negatives, but from any experience, there's pros and cons. How important is the positivity part of it?
I mean, well, I think it's go ahead,
okay,
Tina.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think that that's a really great observation, Sam. I do think it's really important to focus on the positive, especially when you're going through what I would say are pretty important inflection points. You know, just taking, for example, the change that I made after being at the same firm for 25 years up until about 15 months ago, it was a very difficult decision and it was a tough transition, but it was definitely an important new chapter for my career and for my clients and for me developmentally. I think it was a really great experience. And I think that whether it's an inherently positive or negative experience, seeing the bright side of it is always important because it helps you charge through what can sometimes be challenging times. So,
yeah, I agree 100%. You know, one of the pieces of advice I often give to law students, especially second and third year students as they're looking for a job, I say, prepare, don't despair. You know, the legal profession is a tough profession. And if you dwell in the negative, you will likely get lost and drown in it. And you can't avoid difficult times, but if you focus on the positive, I think it just helps you in the long run enjoy your career and move past the difficult times easier.
I feel strongly about regrets because it's one of those things that stays with you and you can't do much to change it. It's really a unique feeling. So I always counsel people, you know, just get out there, do something, try something new. You don't want to have regrets. And personally, just a couple nights ago, I was with my daughter and her friend. We went to a haunted house. We spoke of haunted house earlier. And there was a couple of boys that she ran into. Now, she's a estrogen-laced 14-year-old girl.
They all are.
Wait a minute. Did you rough these kids up?
Absolutely. No. So she walked through the haunted house with me, and there's a couple of boys, you know, nice-looking boys. And she's boy crazy, and she was enamored with these two young lads. And as we were leaving the haunted house, I told her, why don't you go get their numbers? Now, maybe that's bad parenting as a father of a 14-year-old. But I said, you know, why don't you go figure who they are? And she spent about 10 minutes in the car obsessing about whether that's too strong. I said, listen, you don't want to have regrets. I said, you don't want to leave here and not make your, you know, play for these boys. Not to say that they're going to, you know, get into a deep relationship. I said, write a note, give it to the security guy, and get them your number. And I was proud of her that she did.
That's awesome.
Unfortunately, the security guard said, I can't do that. What is your dad, a perv or something? Get out of here. But my point is, I hate regrets, and I try to avoid them at all costs.
I love that story, Rich. I think that was great advice.
Yeah, true.
I really thought it was going a different way.
Yes. Sam, biggest, any regrets you want to share with our listeners?
Signing professionally, contracts, yeah. Signing a contract without reading it.
Oh,
not for a legal face-off, but...
No, not from Legal Face.
I know,
no,
we had a 50-page agreement with you, Sam.
They blindfolded me and said, here, sign.
If only you knew some lawyers that could help you with contracts before you sign them.
No, I mean, not to be too redundant here, but don't make the same mistake twice.
Mm-hmm.
I've made mistakes. We've all made mistakes, but you can't make the same mistake twice.
Yep. No Regrets, also, by the way, a title of an excellent Tom Cochran song, Canada's very own Tom Cochran and Red Ryder. No Regrets is a fantastic song. With that, we will turn it over to Sam to say goodbye to our friends from Inside Out.
Latest edition, No Regrets, and the newest edition will come out in November. That'll be next month. David Sussler, Associate General Counsel, National Material LP, and, of course, Tina Martini here from Legal Faceoff. David, thank you for joining us. We will see you, I believe, at the holiday party, right?
I sure hope so.
Wow.
I thought the Halloween party.
Stay positive, David. We'll talk next
David.
Night.
Holiday party. Thinking positive about the holiday party.
Don't regret it.
Thanks, everyone. Talk to you soon.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
Legal Faceoff, legal grab bag, Rich Lenkoff, Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich. Thanks to Ben Anderson, per usual. This time he's under the glass. He's not beyond or across the glass. And joining us
beneath
in the studio
the
today, executive sports producer here at WGN, Dave Zaslavsky. Hey, Dave.
Hello.
Zaslavsky, I said it right.
Close enough.
White Sox.
Dave and I have worked together. We've also taught class together. And he has done White Sox, Bulls radio. He's done pretty much everything. So
wow.
Good to have Dave in studio.
In the company of greatness.
Well.
And, well.
I don't know about that.
Speechless after that.
And Radhika Sutherland, who is a law student at Loyola and the host of another legal podcast. So I don't know how this slipped through the cracks in the booking. But she's
the Podvocate, right?
I love
Podvocate.
It. The Podvocate.
The Podvocate.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So the way this works, and it's very fun, we just kind of bat it around. Seven topics, some of them legal. Actually, most of them are legal today. Some of them depressing, some of them not. But the first one, involving a word I had to practice several times, emoluments, and this involves...
I thought you meant Trump.
Trump's very easy.
That's an easy word.
Trump claiming now he's the victim of a phony emoluments clause. And for those that don't know, what is an emolument? Because I have no idea.
An emolument is a rule that it's a constitutional rule that a president cannot profit from foreign governments or from the U.S. government by receiving any money while he's president, except for his salary as a president. So in this story, yesterday he claimed that he was the victim of the phony emoluments clause courtesy of the Democrats because he was going to host the G7 summit at his Doral resort. And then he caught a lot of flack over the weekend where folks were saying that he was violating the emoluments clause. And he said it was interesting. There were a couple things he said that I found pretty interesting. First of all, he claimed he would have done it for free so that he would not have actually violated what he's calling the phony emoluments clause. But then I think even the more interesting part of the story is that he claimed that he has lost anywhere from $2 to $5 billion by being president between lost opportunities and just not going out and hustling deals and making money off of his businesses. So in any event, we live in a world where there's phony emoluments clauses.
Yeah, I mean, it's just great that the president, it's not surprising, but the president is calling, I don't know, part of the Constitution phony, as if the Democrats like ginned up this new document called, you know, Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution, it's not phony. He might think that it doesn't apply, and there's certainly a legal argument to be made as to whether he's violating it in this circumstance, but it's not phony. It's something that, you know, dates back to the framers of the Constitution. Whether he violated or not, I mean, I think he does have a point that it's not as clear as the Democrats argue that he is violating it by holding or proposing to hold Doral there. The real reason he canceled it is political, right? I mean, you know, in the middle of everything that's going on with Ukraine and in Syria, it's not a good look for him to be holding this conference at a hotel that bears his name. He doesn't want Joe Biden to be able to argue that this is another example of Trump profiting, and would be actually an article of impeachment. So it's very political, but yeah, there's nothing phony about it. Dave, what do you think of this?
There's so many. It's like, does he have advisors?
Right.
And
lawyers, maybe?
Anyone?
Was he
really bad advisor?
Was he saying that it was phony, or what was in it was phony? My head was spinning when I heard him talking. I've been in this business for 35 years, and I find myself speechless. Like, I talk for a living, and I don't even know what to say sometimes when it comes to this. Like,
well, Veronica, Trump is critical of Hunter Biden, of course, for taking the position with the Ukrainian company. He's now resigned from the company. But, you know, Trump's children and Trump have profited. I mean, Ivanka Trump got a trademark in China that
several trademarks
that people don't get as quickly as she got.
And some of them on voting machines.
Sure. Yeah. And the sons are running around all over the world profiting from their name. So a little bit hypocritical for Trump to be criticizing anyone for profiting off their name.
I know. When I first read this, I mean, I think it all the time, but Jimmy Carter sold his peanut farm. So, I mean, there's no...
But to that point, you know, Billy Carter, his brother, do you remember Billy Beer?
Oh, yeah.
You're old enough to remember Billy Beer. Billy Beer was beer with Billy Carter's face on it. Maybe the first example of a brother. I mean, I don't know what, like, Calvin Coolidge, if he had a brother, like, was running around making money or something, but that was a good example of an early relative making money off the presidency. But
yeah, our founding fathers were very prescient. It took a few hundred years to get here, but right. They figured at some point the presidency is very corruptible by foreign governments, domestic companies, and they were prescient. They put it in there not once but twice. It's in Article 1 and 2. And
my favorite part was on Fox News Sunday, Chris Wallace was interviewing Mick Mulvaney, mm-hmm. who gave that now infamous press conference the other day in which he basically admitted of this quid pro quo. But he also said he was defending Doral as a site for the G7. And he said the president still considers himself in the hospitality business. Chris Wallace said, yeah, but he's the president. He doesn't own, like, he's the president. Doesn't matter what he did before. He's not a hotelier anymore. So, you know, it has to be pointed out to his chief of staff that it's not about hospitality. It's about doing what's, I don't know, legal and constitutional. So that was kind of interesting.
Topic number two, Cuba Gooding Jr. being sued by a bartender.
Yeah, I mean, his legal issues continue. He was indicted last week for this event at a New York City nightclub. He's facing misconduct allegations from 14 women. This stems from a nightclub incident back in October of 2018. Allegedly, the plaintiff in this civil lawsuit, who's a bartender, says that he groped her, that Cuba Gooding said some lewd things to her, and then when she walked away, he spit some liquid out. He later, it's alleged, pinched her on the buttocks. She said, "Don't touch my butt," and he said some other things. So, again, he is alleging that this is not true. He's due back in court on 4 misdemeanor counts on December 13th. So, Cuba Gooding Jr. is facing both civil and criminal liability for this action, along the lines of many actors, many celebrities we've seen in the last year, couple years, being accused of sexual misconduct. Tina?
Not just actors. They're all over.
CEOs, business people, lawyers, all sorts of people.
Yes. So it's unfortunate. I mean, I would rather see his name in the press for being in a great movie, doing some good, and unfortunately, no pun intended with that. But no, I mean, it's one of those things where ultimately it's a very fact specific set of circumstances, but it's based on what I've read. It's not looking too good for him.
Yeah, Radhika, typically defendants in these situations, we've seen it over and over again, especially when they are men, which is the overwhelming situation. They're claiming that their accusers are seeking fame and fortune, and they're seeking to write a book or profit from these allegations, which is in fact what Cuba Gooding has done through his attorney. I always find that, nonsensical, that someone would put themselves through the ringer and allege that they were the victims of sexual assault to what? Gain money? I mean, and what person really has gained notoriety? Are we seeing examples of people going on to acting careers because they're alleging that, they were groped by someone? So kind of a ridiculous reaction by Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yeah, I was a therapist before I went to law school, so I always tend to believe women or believe the victim or believe whoever is claiming that this happened to him. But as a law student, I believe that due process is also very important. You know, there are 14 women at this point who have come out against Cuba Gooding Jr. I'm just thinking, man, take the L, stay out of the public eye and just work on being better so that 14 women wouldn't have the opportunity to accuse you of anything.
Yeah, a little odd, Dave, that 14 women would all be lying. They would all be conspiring. We've seen that defense over and over again. And, everyone from Cosby to Matt Lauer, that, it just so happens that all these women who don't know each other are making these allegations up.
Right. I mean, one is bad enough, but 14, 14 women all of the sudden have fallen out of the sky and are coming up with not the same allegations, but the same allegations. That's kind of hard to believe.
And it's very relevant legally because in the Cosby case, the prosecution tried and was able to at least argue that this established a pattern of criminal misconduct, that because there was 14 women all alleging a similar pattern of behavior by Cosby, then that shows not just, coincidence, but this was an MO, basically. This was a criminal enterprise that followed a pattern by 14 different women. So it's very important legally when you have this group of people because it allows the prosecution to pursue that theory, which is, a little bit stronger.
Topic three, I have used some bad passwords over the years, mostly when I was about 9, 10, 11 years old. Now, this password, Rich, I'll tee you up on this. Using the username and password as admin, A-D-M-I-N, for sensitive data, not a good idea.
Yeah, well, listen, we all realize that given the security systems we live in, we have to change our passwords, right? But we are lay people. What's shocking in this case, according to a class action lawsuit filed in federal court in Georgia, is that Equifax, right? There are three credit reporting companies in this country, one of which is Equifax, who we trust with taking care of our data, and was, of course, the subject of a massive data breach back a couple of years ago in 2017. We have learned that this massive data breach was basically because the worst password ever was used, not just the password, but the username, both of which were admin. Just linger for a second on that. Like, you would think Equifax, a company that has access to, billions of pieces of our data, wouldn't think to have a more secure password or username than a 7-year-old would have? Shocking. And, I'm glad this is an example. I think a lot of class actions are nonsensical. We've had some class action attorneys on our show. Frequent friend of the show, Joe Siprit,
yes,
has done well as a class action attorney. Frequently, they are, relatively nonsensical and a means for attorneys to make a lot of money. In this case, I'm glad there are class actions because, Equifax needs to learn from this and do things better because data breaches have real effects on people and real monetary effects.
Well, and especially considering how sophisticated data breaches are these days, they can get through walls, they can get through triple encryption, they can get through so many different layers of protection and security. you know, sometimes, I mean, I've heard there's an ideology that sometimes when you use the obvious because people think you can't possibly be doing that, that, you know, that's a great way to protect yourself. But
or you're dumb.
Or you're dumb. Right. Exactly. But no, I mean, like, you probably don't want to use like any sort of default password, you know, to start working on a system as your actual password, because that, you know, these types of things happen. I saw it at my old firm. It wasn't good.
Dave, 147 million people were affected by the data breach in 2017. And Equifax settled with the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, for $425 million just this past September. But this lawsuit continues. So, scary? Yeah?
I mean, very scary. I mean, this, like you mentioned, there are really three, you know, three main companies up on top of the mountain that really control things. And this is their username and password.
You had one job.
Like, this is your, this is their username and password. It's really scary.
Didn't even like, capitalize the A.
What? Like,
use a one for the
what
I?
What were the username and passwords that they didn't choose? Right. Like, I mean,
what was rejected? One, two, three, four.
It's really scary. Like, these are the three companies that control how, you know, can you buy a home?
Right.
Like, And this is what they choose. Like, who's making these decisions?
Veronica, you're on this jury.
Yeah.
How
long are you out? If you're on this jury, how long are you out?
No, I mean,
2 minutes.
Of all the stories that I read, this one was actually the most shocking and most embarrassing. Is Equifax being run by all of our collective grandparents? Like, what is going on at that company? My iPhone suggests stronger passwords every time I, like, create a new account. Yeah. It suggests, like, a very complex password. They should have at least done that at the very least.
I can see your password being rich at home.
Too obvious. It's so obvious that it's brilliant.
My dad once used the ever popular password for his password and wondered how we got into his computer all those times.
There's always password exclamation mark.
Well, now they're dummy proof. You have to at least use a symbol or a number. So you have to change, you know, the A to the at symbol.
Equifax didn't even have that technology implemented.
Yeah, there's 300 million Russians right now who are just like licking their chops, thinking of the amount of data breaches they can successfully infiltrate on our country.
A federal judge granted a lawyer and his request to push back a briefing deadline so him and his son could watch a baseball game. I have never heard of this.
Wow.
It's America right there.
It is America. It's all about, you know, apple pie and hot dogs and, you know, all America. That great stuff. It's America. So a federal judge in D.C. decided to grant a lawyer's request to push back a briefing deadline when he petitioned the court with opposing counsel's consent to be given an extension so that he and his 9-year-old son could watch the Nationals, who are now in the World Series. So it's very interesting when you read through what his motion said. He actually went through the whole story about how the Nats were doing at the beginning of the season, losing the 31 of the first 50 games, and saying, you know, even despite that his 9-year-old son was very much supportive of the team and that he would like to have the opportunity to stay up late to watch games with his son to cheer on their team. So
wasting the court's time with nonsense.
Well, apparently this is not nonsense because the motion was granted and it was actually almost a tear-jerking sort of response.
We got to go to our White Sox man Dave on this one because listen, I'm actually a bit of a Nats fan. I grew up in Montreal. Expos maniac, and it's a little different with the Nats. You can't really be a Nats fan if you're an Expos fan, but this speaks to a problem. The games are too damn late for kids. Oh. And baseball is losing, as you'll know from being a White Sox producer. Baseball doesn't resonate with kids the way it used to when we were growing up, right? I mean, most kids now are into the NBA first, maybe the NFL, but they don't care so much about baseball. Part of the reason is these games are so damn late.
Well, the games are... Believe me, the games are too late for kids. The games are too late for adults.
Yeah.
Believe me, these
are ending on the
four and a half hour games. And I understand, you know what? Washington has not been to the World Series, I believe, since the 30s was the last time the Senators were in the World Series. This is a pretty big deal. I understand.
You would grant the motion.
I would grant the motion and move on. There are more important cases.
The first pitch game one is at 8:08 Eastern time.
It's so I mean midnight, so after midnight.
Yeah, if you're a grade schooler watching the Nationals, you're up until probably at least midnight. And if they win, you can't go to bed until probably one or two because you're so jacked up.
So, Radhika, you're a 2L. Mm-hmm. You will learn so many excuses to give the judge as to why you're not prepared. But this is a pretty good one. The judge agreed.
It's a delightful one. I think that humanity is important. It's very important for lawyers to show humanity and judges. And I like this. I tried to go to a Cubs game. Cubs fan, sorry. Not sorry,
don't
actually.
Apologize.
Yeah, absolutely not sorry. Take back my apology.
Get out! You're on WGN microphone right there.
I tried to go to a Cubs game after class this past semester, and we could not make it through the whole game. It was so late. So, yeah, it applies.
There are plenty of tickets at White Sox Park.
There are tickets available, that is changing. Dwindling.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't do it for
that
free.
Is dwindling.
All right, so give us a preview tonight. What are we looking at? What's the prediction? What's the prediction overall for the series?
Well,
baseball
the Nationals
guys?
Are a big underdog in the series. Uh-huh. So to win $100 in Vegas on the Astros, you have to put down $220 to win $100. If you put $100 on the Nationals, you win $190. So they're a pretty sizable underdog. But
Astros are coming with a head of steam off that Altuve
home run,
right? Walk off. I love the. I mean, is it the best pitching matchup in World Series history? Right?
The you've got Scherzer and Cole, Strasburg and Verlander, Greinke and Corbin.
And you're forgetting the guy who started off this series for the Nats, who threw a two-hitter?
One-hitter? Sanchez, yeah. Right, yeah.
It's incredible.
Probably not a lot of
best pitching ever in a World
Series? Best pitching ever?
It's got to be up there. Clements against Gooden.
I wasn't prepared for this question.
Yeah, Clements against Gooden was pretty strong back in like 85, but as a group, best pitching matchup ever.
These are two pretty good pitching staffs.
I mean, Cole is ridiculous.
Last team to beat Cole was the White Sox.
Is that right?
Oh, look at that.
Wow, look at that.
Back in May. Yeah. That was his last loss, back in May against the White Sox.
And he's striking out like 12 guys per game.
Yeah, I got Stros in like six. I wish the Nats are going to win, but Stros are pretty strong.
So you can't root for the Nationals just because of the
Expos? No, I can. It's just a little weird. You know, I do like the Nats, but you know, they keep referring to the National Expos franchise. It's like, it's not. It's two different franchises in my mind.
If we do have game six or seven during legal faceoff, we'll allocate accordingly, and we'll move the show so you can stay up late and watch.
I'll motion to do that. I'll move to do that.
Okay, a couple topics left here. This one, Tina, involving The Game, which is a rapper, and he has a pretty big check to cut after an assault trial.
Yeah, are you a Game fan?
I am not.
Okay, are there any fans of The Game?
I think it's The Game.
It's The Game. There is a "the," but I'm putting a "duh" in front of there instead.
Okay.
So
don't like him either.
Yeah, well, so I don't really like him either, unfortunately, after this story. So the Seventh Circuit just agreed with the circuit court on this issue, which is The Game actually, the story starts back in 2015. He was filming She's Got Game Here, took one of the contestants on that VH1 series, took her out on a date. It was not filmed for purposes of the show. She claims that he was lifting her skirt and groping her in a bar. She confronted him about it. That confrontation was actually on camera. She sued him for sexual battery. He lost back in 2016. He ended up being told that he had to pay her $6 million in punitive damages and a little over $1 million in compensatory damages. He tried he moved for a new trial, saying that he really didn't get the right side of the law on this one. And the judge didn't like him, clearly. I mean, there were a number of things that he did. He evaded process, number one. He didn't show up for the trial. He claimed that he had a dental procedure and used that as an excuse for not showing up, and said that he moved for a new trial nevertheless. And the Seventh Circuit agreed that his conduct was so outrageous and egregious that the lower court's holding stood. So he owes her a little bit over $7 million. So I would put this in the Cuba Gooding Jr. bucket of bad activities, unfortunately.
Shame on The Game.
Does anybody listen to The Game here? Does anybody know who The Game is?
I do not listen.
I have in my past, but it's one of those R. Kelly, Chris Brown, Michael Jackson cases where I've been really, you know, trying to debate whether I can separate the art from the artist. In this case, I don't know. Judge Feinerman was actually the judge in this case. I took a class that he taught in Rome, Italy this summer.
Oh, cool.
I have immense respect for the man. I understand how he deliberative and thoughtful he is about the decisions that he makes. So I am always going to agree with the decision that Judge Feinerman
made. Dave, can you separate the performer or the athlete from the alleged crime? Aroldis Chapman came to Chicago a couple years ago for the Cubs run. That was right after he had been alleged of some sexual misconduct, and I think he was suspended, right?
Yes.
You know, it's hard as a fan of a player sometimes to separate what they are alleged to do off the field from what they do for their career. The same thing could be applied to celebrities or musicians.
Well, I do think it's funny how sometimes people do put their fan blinders on and forget about it. Like when Chapman showed up here, all of a sudden Cub fans forgot.
Well, right.
Not all Cub fans, but some Cub fans forgot.
Yeah, because he throws 106 miles an hour.
Right. I mean. But this situation, I mean, contests like this, this has always scared me. And I've worked at a number of radio stations. I don't know if that's good or bad, but for the purposes of this, it's good. And contests like this have always scared me because, you know, you're doing the dating game on the morning show and you're putting two people together, and that's great. The producer goes out with the two people, but what happens after? You're connecting these two people. Who's liable for this?
Oh, the radio station? Remember there's that case a few years ago where that happened and the guy came out. I think he shot the woman, or there was some crime afterwards because he was so surprised at the reaction. So, I mean, you're asking for a world of trouble by putting these people together, no question.
And then you're putting this guy's a celebrity,
of course,
air quotes, on top of all of this. This is a very slippery slope for me.
Better have good waivers, good releases, and all that stuff.
Absolutely.
Two topics left to go, Rich. This one, I'll just read the title here from the Phoenix New Times. Dog pee or scorpions, ? Cubs president Theo Epstein's wild landlord-tenant dispute.
We got scorpions, we got dog pee, just your normal legal face-off story, yeah. Theo Epstein is the GM, or president of the Cubs, and he is the subject of a lawsuit alleging that his dog went to town on this house he was renting back in 2015 in Arizona when the Cubs were there for spring training. And the allegation is that this is a $1 million house, and that his dog peed prolifically. I'm not sure how you could pee prolifically, but
his 10-pound dog.
A lot of pee.
Yeah, so stained allegedly the flooring, the tile and the stone, and the door jams, cabinets, and furniture. In addition, the dog caused drywall holes and broken cabinet handles and a whole world of hurt at this house. The vice president for the Cubs has called this allegation baseless, and that the dog stains were already there when he moved in. The interesting piece of evidence that came out is this quote from Theo Epstein where he talks about his dog peeing. Back in 2017, Theo Epstein talks about not having time to even get his dog to stop peeing in the house. So as an attorney, you look for pieces of evidence, right? And to me, that's pretty strong evidence that his dog is a prolific peer, because Epstein said that this dog was peeing all over the house. Now, was he referring to that house or not? Who knows? But I think
once
that's pretty good evidence.
Once a peer, always a peer.
Yeah. A urinator. But there's also scorpions involved.
Okay, that
Theo
was
Epstein
scary
came back
stuff.
And said that the problem wasn't the dog urine, my dog peeing. It was scorpions all over the house threatening my kids.
I found
so
that
he's
very
now fighting
troubling.
Back.
Yeah, I mean, pee never hurt anybody. But scorpions, my mother was Mexican, and she grew up in Mexico where there were all these deadly scorpions everywhere. And so I'm hypersensitive to stories about scorpions. And yeah, I mean, apparently in that area, those scorpions, while they're not lethal, they can do some pretty serious damage to
people. Yeah, there's an established adult and juvenile scorpion population, according to Epstein's, according to this complaint.
At the house.
Yes. And these Arizona bark scorpions, as they're called, are the most venomous species found in the Southwest. So Epstein is fighting back with a scorpion allegation.
So as a law student, we do something called issue spotting a lot, right? As I read this article, I spotted many issues. First being, this dog is 10 pounds. How much pee is a 10-pound dog producing? Enough to
stain? Well, I'm glad you asked, because studies show...
And then are we sure it's the same dog as 2017? Does Theo Epstein just perpetually have dogs that can't stop peeing?
Maybe he had other dogs over.
Yeah, who knows? And then... why did they not leave when they saw the first scorpion in their children's bedroom? Like, I don't know why they eventually left with only 2 weeks left on this lease. They probably should have left much sooner than that.
First scorpion, you're out.
Yes, absolutely.
General
That's my
rule.
Policy. Our family policy is one scorpion and we're done.
I mean, you're in the desert. There are scorpions in the desert, first of all. And second of all...
caveat emptor. The legal theory of let the buyer beware, right?
I learned that on the Brady
Absolutely.
Bunch.
Absolutely.
I mean, and why,
that series taught us so much about life and about the law.
Exactly. And when you get to the house, if there's already pee stains there, why aren't you doing something about absolutely. It then? Call the landlord and say, hey, there's a lot of, just want you to know, here's a couple pictures. There's pee stains all over.
Well,
the
it's
place.
Like the great Eddie Murphy has a great bit about if he was staying at the house, if he bought the Amityville Horror House, it's like, yeah, the first time you see blood coming out of the wall, it's like, yeah, we're out of here. You know?
Right.
Maybe that's a sign that this is not the best house for you.
Right.
Last topic here on Legal Face Off involves spooky Halloween lawsuits.
Yeah, we like to cover every year at different holidays weird and wacky lawsuits around the holiday. And Halloween, of course, is ripe for these kind of stories. We see a lot of haunted house lawsuits. There's a couple that we looked at involving people who get scared. There's one where there was a chainsaw-wielding character come out and the person got scared and tripped as they ran out and sued the haunted house. There's another where there's a costume of a homemade sheep, and this person lit a cigarette, and oddly enough, the costume caught on fire. Who would have thought that cotton balls
are flammable?
And fire doesn't mix. The underlying legal theory here is, you know, don't do dumb shit, right? And you see people sue for doing dumb shit all the time, and thankfully there's a concept in the law called contributory fault, right? Comparative fault. That if you go to a haunted house, you should be aware that there are scary things that happen. And in fact, in most of these establishments, you actually sign a release or waiver of liability. Whether those hold up in a court of law, I've got a lot of experience defending those, and it's not as easy to enforce as you think. The point is, when you go to a haunted house, don't sue someone because you fall, because you're scared. That's part of the deal, and you assume the risk of that when you walk in there. Yeah? Anyone disagree?
I agree. It's interesting. I mean, I used to go to haunted houses a lot. It's been a few years since I've gone. I never signed a waiver. But you go all the time. I know Halloween
Things
is your favorite holiday.
Things are more litigious now because of dumb lawsuits. Yeah, we go to a lot of haunted houses. We went to three on Sunday night in about 90 minutes. We powered through them. But, Radhika, you're learning all this stuff in law school right now. Comparative fault. You see some crazy cases. What do you think of these stories?
I don't know if I'm prepared to talk about torts right now. ugly semester for me.
Yeah.
Actually, for our podcast, The Podvocate, we're doing a whole episode we're recording on Thursday. I was going to get it in there. I promised I would get it in there. We're doing a whole episode surrounding spooky stories involving haunted houses, haunted courthouses, the woman marrying the ghost. And being raped by ghosts. You guys know this.
Save it for the pod.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Not going to give away too much, but it's kind of amazing how many of these lawsuits exist. During my research, I found that there are hundreds and hundreds of them. And generally, they all go the same way. The haunted house will be found not liable because people know what they're getting into when they go to a haunted house.
Yes.
And
or do they? Dave?
I'm sorry, but if you are wearing a homemade costume... of a sheep made of cotton balls, and you light a cigarette, you deserve the consequences.
You deserve to burn to death.
Period.
Absolutely.
I mean, period.
I don't know.
Sam, what are you going as for Halloween this year?
I wanted to find a friend and go as a team from Supermarket Sweep. So you get the sweater with the numbers, and then we just put all of our booze in a shopping cart.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
And then you could take what you want out of the cart, like right. little mini airline bottles or something.
Best costume ever. Let's go around the room.
You mean that I've worn?
That you've worn.
I went 1 year as Jim McMahon.
Ooh, I like
pretty
that.
Good.
The headband and everything?
All the headband, the sunglasses, number nine, all of it.
Did you slam your head against the wall before you went up?
Veronica?
So I think in college we had some great costumes.
You guys have in law school? We used to have a Paul's Graph dance, which was like at the Halloween party.
Speaking of torts.
That still a thing?
No.
Oh, okay.
Thank God. In college, my friends and I went as the three wise men, but I refuse to acknowledge the one whiskey, I won't say the name, so I went as Jim Beam instead because I'm from Kentucky.
Asking for a friend.
But this year, I think my husband and I are going to go as Sheila and Osho from Wild Wild Country, the documentary.
Nice.
Yeah, I'll be the one.
All right.
One year, I dressed as Peter Criss.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I was just impressed because I did it myself.
Yeah.
Did the makeup myself.
That's incredible. It's hard to do on yourself. Did you do like shirtless towel Beth singing Peter Criss?
I did shirtless leather vest.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which was scary, but I was much younger.
Yeah. And love me some Peter Criss.
What about you?
Well, so I like to do these topical ones every year. So a couple of years ago, I went as AP, as Adrian Peterson.
I remember you had the switch.
I had the switch, and I had a little baby. Maybe too soon.
It was so bad.
It was too soon. And then another year, I did the dentist. This was relevant at the time, but most people don't remember it. But there was a dentist who was highly criticized, rightfully so, for killing a lion. He went on a safari and like killed a lion, so I had the dentist code.
Cecil.
A lot. There you go. You remember.
Wow. So I had a
lion head.
I remember the dentist's name, too, but we're not going to give him any publicity.
Yeah, so I went as the lion-killing dentist 1 year.
This year?
I'm still trying to come up with something.
You got a couple days.
Yeah.
You'll figure
it out. Save it for the Halloween show.
Rodica, Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great job.
You.
Check out the Podvocate.
Absolutely.
Give us a shout out on the Podvocate anytime you want.
You bet.
He will be listening for the shout out.
And White Sox, what's the prediction for White Sox record next year? Over 500 for sure, right?
I'm going to say over 500.
90 wins, we looking at?
Ooh. I think they're a playoff team next year.
Yeah.
I think they spent a lot of money in the offseason.
Yeah, I'm gonna say they will have a better record than the Cubs.
Ooh, wow! Look at that. Heard it here first. Coming in hot.
Love it. Have a happy Halloween. Always check your candy wherever you get it. For Rich and Tina, my name is Sam. Thanks to Ben as well. We'll talk to you next time on Legal Face Off.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand.